Thousands of people arrive in Canada seeking asylum from economic, physical, and political violence. Many are accepted with refugee status, while many others are turned away. The Conservative government of Canada recently introduced a piece of legislation to reform the country's refugee system. To discuss how government policy affects the lives of queer and trans refugees, I'm joined on the phone by Sherilyn Jordan. Sherilyn is completing her doctoral research on queer refugee settlement and is a member of the Rainbow Refugee Committee. Hello, Sherilyn.
Good morning.
So before we talk about the system here in Canada, the refugee system, what kinds of problems are queer and trans refugees fleeing?
To give you a sense of kind of the picture internationally, there are 80 countries that criminally sanction lesbian, gay, bi, or trans people. And then there are others that also use things like morality laws or laws against public assembly to criminally sanction queer and trans people. There are five that maintain the death penalty. I can give you some examples of situations that Rainbow Refugee members have left. So we have quite a few folks from Sri Lanka, and the situation they faced there was when they met at a beach that was kind of known as a place for queer people to hang out, as they were leaving, they would be picked up by police. Sri Lanka maintains a 12-year prison sentence for homosexuality, although it's rarely used. But the existence of these sanctions would be used by the police to then threaten and extort money from people. Many were beaten or sexually assaulted while they were in custody by police. And then the police would return sort of once a month asking for more money and threatening to out them if they didn't pay up. So that kind of gives a sense of the kinds of things people are having to deal with, queer and trans people are having to deal with. So people have to live with a great deal of constraint and in hiding in order to survive.
So there's definitely state-sanctioned violence happening all around the world.
Yes, yes. There's state-sanctioned violence happening in at least, as I said, 80 countries. There are also situations where it may not be state-sanctioned, but countries don't have anti-discrimination laws or measures to protect queer and trans people, and then there's sort of pervasive social intolerance and violence, and so people facing those kinds of situations would also be able to make a claim for refugee protection.
Right. So before this recent reform, what did it take for queer and trans folks to be accepted under refugee status?
Yeah, one of the most challenging things is people cannot make a refugee claim in their own country. They have to get out of their own country and make this claim at either a UNHCR office or in Canada itself. And often the hardest thing for people is getting out, particularly for women and also for trans folks. Crossing borders is really challenging. Getting a visa to come into Canada is very hard if you don't have property, if you don't have significant ties to your country. So that's, I think, one of the most challenging things people deal with. And then once they've actually made their claim, the situation here in Canada, I think I'll focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
People arrive, and sort of the first thing that they deal with is needing to look a government official in the eye and say, I need to make a refugee claim. And then the question they'll deal with is, on what grounds? For folks who have had to be very, you know, very careful and cautious about who they disclose their sexuality or gender to, this is a really frightening moment. So that's sort of the second challenge people deal with. I know one fellow who spent 27 days in detention here in Canada before kind of working up the nerve to tell his duty counsel.
Wow.
That he was gay and that was why he needed to make a refugee claim.
So these would be like customs and border agents, or once they've reached a city, or
typically at an airport.
Okay.
They'll be the officers of the Canada Border Services will be the first people that they speak to, unless they come into Canada sort of as a student or on a temporary work permit, that kind of thing, and then they would make an in-land claim at an office of citizenship and immigration, and then they're working with an immigration official. Either way, it's a government officer, and for folks coming from countries where police and officials are exactly the people they've needed to be careful of, this is a really terrifying moment.
Right, and what do they need to be able to provide those government officials to be accepted?
Under the current system, that first interview just makes sure that they're eligible to make a refugee claim. And so this is fairly, you know, they don't need to provide a lot of documentation at this point. They then go and work with a lawyer who helps them put together all of their evidence. And this includes things like needing to document their sexual orientation or their gender identity. So that can involve sort of getting letters from past lovers, sometimes letters, hospital records or medical records, that kind of thing for trans folks. And then also documenting their fear of persecution in their home country. So that can be, again, sort of if they've had dealings with the police, whatever, trying to retrieve whatever records there are of that. And that, as you can imagine, is quite tough. Those are all compiled and given to the refugee board 20 days before their hearing. After 1 month, they provide a narrative that explains the basis of their case. And then 20 days before their hearing, they put in all their documentation.
And then what happens after their hearing?
So their hearing, we might want to talk a little bit about what that looks like. There's a member of the refugee board listening to their and asking questions about their case. Sometimes there's a representative of the government there as well, sort of asking questions from a perspective of protecting the integrity of the refugee system. And they're working through an interpreter. So there's usually about three people in the room, as well as the lawyer and the claimant. And the challenges there are around, you know, in this really kind of tense, kind of quasi-judicial space, having to talk about really, you know, quite intimate, sometimes very painful memories, sometimes memories that are connected with physical trauma or sexual trauma, with a person who holds kind of absolute life or death decision-making power.
No kidding.
So that's the hearing. And then sometimes people find out right away at the hearing that they've been granted refugee protection. Sometimes there's a wait. You know, we know people who've had to wait, you know, a couple of weeks. I know one person who's waited over a year to hear. Now, that doesn't happen often, but it can happen.
And then if it does take up to a year, what do people do? How do they get by?
Once a person is found eligible to make a refugee claim, you know, and that happens fairly early, they can submit an application for a work permit.
Okay.
Okay. And it takes usually a couple of months, and then they apply for work. We know folks who are kind of scraping by, piecing together two and three part-time jobs while they wait. They're also eligible for social assistance, and that kicks in, again, as soon as people are found eligible to make a refugee claim. And so many people do require social assistance for sort of the first few months while they're waiting for their work permit.
Mm-hmm. So it's by no means an easy process.
No.
Or it was by no means an easy process.
No.
Before this reform.
People are living in a great deal of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and dealing with kind of, all the struggles of getting by in a new culture, a new city, trying to rebuild a home, a life, friends, while their lives are in limbo.
And then now with this conservative government reform legislation, Bill C-11, how will this bill change the process for these queer and trans refugees?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that are really important about the new reform package. And I'll be honest, we're not fully sure what it's going to look like when it's actually implemented. The devil's often in the details. But one of the things we're concerned about is there's a provision now it's called the designated country list. So what this does is it gives the minister's office power to say people from certain nations will now be processed in an expedited way, in a faster way. Okay? We are happy that provision was changed pretty substantially from the original version. The original version would have denied right of appeal to people from countries on the list, and that would have been fundamentally unjust. The expedited processing is an improvement over that, but still something we're concerned about. The other major concern we have about the new reforms is that people no longer will be making their first, sort of telling their story for their first time with a lawyer. Instead, they've added an interview at 15 days with a government official. So it's actually, in a way, adding a step to the process, which is interesting because they say that it's about efficiency, and I'm not sure how adding a step makes something more efficient, but that we'll see. So they have an interview with a government official now at 15 days. Our concerns around that is that quite often people don't have time to connect with a lawyer within 15 days. With the way legal aid works here and just making an appointment and things like that, it's often people don't have a lawyer within their first 15 days. And going into an interview where they're going to be collecting evidence without a lawyer is really frightening for all refugees. It's particularly worrisome for queer and trans refugees because often the ways that queer and trans people experience persecution are kind of hidden from view, and people who've grown up believing that their sexuality or gender is sinful or a mental illness may not think in terms of their lives in terms of human rights and be able to give us an explanation of what's happened to them in human rights terms.
It's a very particular discourse they need to use.
Exactly. So just, maybe an everyday example to ground this a bit. Often the things that are most disturbing to people are the ways that their own families have hurt them. But that is not in itself persecution. It only becomes persecution if it becomes threatening and there is no mechanism in the state to protect them. But if people don't know that, what they may emphasize when the officer says, what was your problem in your home country, may be all the things that went on in their family. And they may not think to say, and I was afraid to go to the police or the police wouldn't do anything or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What we have seen already is that whatever people say when they first arrive, comes back at the hearings. Those notes are recorded and looked at during hearings. And one of the things that they use as sort of evidence of credibility of a person is, does your story say the same? Does it say consistent from one time to the next? And they don't look at sort of what are the conditions that people are telling these explaining themselves under. But does it stay the same? And so if somebody's faced with a government official 15 days after arrival, they may be too frightened, too traumatized, just not having the trust.
Mm-hmm.
Speak openly about something like, sexual violence or even their first sexual experience with an officer.
Right.
And then if those things aren't in that initial interview or the details are, a little bit vague, it could undermine their credibility in their hearing.
Wow.
Yeah. That first interview, Peter Schaller is a refugee, let's say, scholar who has worked in the IRB and now writes extensively. And his principles for good, fair, effective refugee decision-making is the first decision should be the best decision.
Right.
And anything that gets in the way of that, it undermines fairness and undermines efficiency. So to my mind, this 15-day interview with a government officer is counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. And so just to clarify this, this designated country of origin,
mm-hmm.
The minister's office Like, does this mean that the minister's office has the power to choose which countries are on that list and which aren't?
That's correct. And the process for how that gets decided is will get written into the rules and regulations. And so we haven't seen what that will look like yet, and that's one of our concerns. What we are going to ask for is that there be somebody with, you know, with expertise on LGBT, you know, queer and trans human rights issues, involved in that process, and who would have the power to ask that a country be removed from the list if situations change. Because this is, I'm making distinctions between safe and unsafe, which is kind of implicitly what they're doing with this list. Although, you know, we managed to get rid of that, the language of safe, in the bill, fortunately. Is really tough when it comes to persecution against queer and trans people. Situations are in flux. It may be very different from one part of a country to another, you know, the capital city versus different regions, that kind of thing. And also people's own kind of, their social class, their faith, their gender can impact how persecution affects them. So it's really hard to make cut and dry kind of, yes, this country should be on the list. No, this country shouldn't be on a list when it comes to queer and persecution against queers and trans folks.
And how did the Canadian government justify this reform?
Well, Minister Kenney has talked about sort of sudden surges from countries where, to his mind, it's very clear people are making unfounded refugee claims. And the examples that come up are Czech and Mexico. And so what the way they handled that initially was just slapping a visa requirement on folks traveling from either Czech or Mexico. That doesn't work real well if you're wanting to have trade with these countries. And as a member of NAFTA, Canada's invested in having good trade relations with Mexico.
Right.
So they had to get rid of the visa requirement. So this is, in some ways, a preferred way of dealing with these surges, because it at least allows people to come into Canada and make a claim and have access to refugee protection. And we do still see situations where people from Mexico have a very legitimate need for refugee protection. The situation there is quite violent, and because of drug issues in certain regions, and so the police are overwhelmed. So we do see situations where people cannot access state protection, despite kind of quite good constitutional protection on paper in some parts of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And including the recognition of same-sex relationships in Mexico City, but that doesn't always translate into people being able to be safe.
Yeah.
And so people, quite legitimately leave their country because they don't feel safe. They know they're in danger. And that distinction between whether it's persecution or not is a complex one.
Mm-hmm.
So the designated country list gives the state one way to kind of move people through the refugee decision process more quickly.
And what would a reform look like, to you, what would a reform look like that actually put the needs of these impacted refugees at the center of its policy?
I think one of the first things to look at is how people actually access refugee protection. Most Western countries have put up, fairly stringent migration controls to prevent people even reaching Canada if they're from what's considered a refugee-producing country. And so we need to be looking at sort of the accessibility of refugee protection at UNHCR offices overseas, and can people make it safely to a place where they can make a refugee claim? That would be one of the first things that I would look at. And then the second would be to look at, what are the conditions people are being asked to give their account, to explain what has happened to them. So rather than putting them face to face with a government official where they're dealing with disbelief, I would put them, you know, with somebody who they know is representing them first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we need to be looking at the quality of evidence that people, that refugee decision makers have access to. This is a real issue for homophobic and transphobic persecution in particular. It's taken a while for mainstream human rights organizations to start doing the kind of research that's needed around queer and trans persecution.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that we need to improve on. And then really working to maintain the independence of decision makers. And that's something that's potentially undermined in this new reform package as well that I didn't talk about. But
independence from whom?
Independence from government. We need to make sure that the refugee process does not get politicized. So right now, the refugee board, all of the people making decisions are they're part of an independent body. They are appointed by government council, so they are not civil servants. It gives them, you know, at least in principle, some independence from the policies and values and priorities of Canadian citizenship and immigration.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your analysis with us today and your overview of the system.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for your interest. I'm really glad to see that we're getting, that more attention is being drawn to issues around refugee protection, and particularly refugee protection for queer and trans people.
What would you recommend for people to do if they would like to help push the government in that direction of a better system?
Yeah, thank you. Important question.
Yeah.
Well, how to get engaged, absolutely. Really good resource is for people to go to the Canadian Council for Refugee website, and there's up-to-date information there on the refugee reform package and issues there. And if people are wanting to get specifically involved around queer and trans refugees, please contact us at Rainbow Refugee, and I'll give you our email. It's info@rainbowrefugee.ca, and we also have a blog that we'll direct people to.
Great. Well, yeah, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you so much, Peter. Take care.
I have been speaking with Sherilyn Jordan. She's a member of the Rainbow Refugee Committee, and if you'd like more information on their work, you can email them, as she said, at info@rainbowrefugee.ca. And what was your blog again, the website?
It's rainbowrefugeecanada@wordpress.com.
Great.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.